been? How amazing to see you here again.
It's been quite a journey, John.
Yeah, I'm so excited this time because we get to do arguably four releases today. Because there's 156, there's the Rust 2021 edition, there's Rust 156.1, and there's Rust 157.
It's going to be quite a day, that's for sure.
Yeah, or night. Is it or late? I don't know.
It's really relative, right? We can't assume whoever's listening to this right now is actually, you know, asleep. Maybe they're actually, our soothing voices might lull them off, and that's kind of their one ritual. They can only sleep every 3 months.
I mean, there are probably people like that. I mm-hmm. think there are probably people using our very soft and soothing voices to fall asleep.
Oh man, ASMR episode suddenly.
I know, right? That's really what this channel is all about, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Putting people to sleep.
That's what every podcast eventually evolves towards.
Yeah, exactly. I think we should just dig right into 156. What do you think?
I'm into it. Let's jump in.
So obviously the big headline feature of 156 is the Rust 2021 edition, which was like planned and announced, I think, back in May, and has sort of gone through all the procedures since of figuring out what exactly should and shouldn't be in the edition. Do you want to talk a little bit about what an edition is, just to sort of recap?
Yeah, it's useful to kind of just like reemphasize what an edition is. It's kind of Rust's solution for evolving a language while being able to make quote unquote breaking changes without actually breaking anybody. And so the idea is that users can opt in to breaking changes. So, and also that the compiler can perform most changes automatically so that you'd actually, whenever you're migrating, you don't really need to. And also, whenever you get a new version of the compiler, if you create a new project using cargo new, it will automatically opt you in to the new edition so that new projects over time tend to be on new editions. And so it's a very kind of like gentle, gradual, but inexorable push towards having a language that is like quote unquote modern in terms of like correcting mistakes or giving itself wiggle room for future development, which we'll see here shortly. And the important thing to note is that two crates on different editions can always interlink. You can always interoperate. There's no like split in the ecosystem. Underneath every Rust code, every Rust code base or Rust, you know, compilation unit thing that you get, every library is all the same. They can all talk to each other on the same compiler version. So it's incredibly useful, and it's once every 3 years or so it seems to come. And this is our new gift that we can now present to you.
So, yeah. And I guess explicitly also part of it is that there's no sort of release train, really. It's not like, oh, we need to rush this to get it into the next edition, or, oh, if we miss this edition, we have to wait another 3 years. My understanding, at least, is that it's more when we feel like we need to do an edition and it's sort of the right time to do an edition, then we do one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think there's kind of a general cadence for like every 3 years, but that's not like, that's not set in stone. It's totally up to the people making it. All the volunteers can decide. And we'll see that this edition actually compared to the previous one is a bit less impactful. There's still plenty of great stuff, but we can expect over time that as Rust gets more mature, the things that people regret will be reduced in terms of things that we're not making more mistakes, hopefully, as we develop the language, and that the pace slows down. So eventually, maybe there won't be any more additions. Who knows? But the option's always there, and this time there's some great stuff in it. Let's start.
Yeah, and it seems to be working pretty well too so far.
Yeah, I mean, like people continue to love it. I think we want to see more languages doing this. I think it's going to be a big thing in the future. I don't want to say Rust is the first one to do this. I think that like back in the 90s, there was some Scheme variant that like started doing this in terms of like you would opt into a new version and it would like enable new things. And obviously, if you talk about like use strict from Perl and later JavaScript, it's kind of the same thing. We're opting into sort of a quote unquote better version of the language. So, but this is the most formalized it's been in terms of like any kind of, is Rust mainstream? I won't say a mainstream language, but I'm not sure if Rust is quite mainstream yet. What do you think?
I think Rust is going mainstream. I think it's right on the curb. All right, so let's dig into the very first part of the new edition, at least as mentioned in the release notes, which is disjoint captures in closures. Now, this is something that's sort of been fielded a little bit up and down. It's been available on Nightly, I think, for a while. And the very basic idea here is that if you have a closure that uses a field of some struct, like let's say you have a struct X and you want to access field Y inside of the closure, then the closure will only now capture a borrow of Y, or take Y by value, whatever the closure needs, rather than bring all of X with it. There are a couple of cases where this comes up. For me, I think the most compelling one is if you have let's say you have a method on a struct that takes a mute self, and inside of it, you have a closure that maybe, I don't know, filters an iterator or something. So it has to consume, probably in a read-only fashion, some field from the struct. But then you're also in that same method trying to mutate a different field of self. In the past, that wouldn't really be doable because the closure would end up capturing all of self in order to reference that one field, and therefore you can mutably access the field that you wanted to change. Or you could do it, but you would have to introduce some intermediate variable outside of the closure that captures only that field by reference and then move that reference into the closure in order for the borrow checker to sort of understand what you meant. Whereas now with this partial capture, this will just work out of the box, which I think is a really nice change.
Speaking of methods, we should mention too that there's a common frustration in Rust about the borrow checker, where if you have a method that takes self by reference, that it might make it a bit more difficult to work with because it'll borrow the entire structure. It'll borrow it all of self and not just any fields you want to work with. This does not fix that problem.
Yeah, so the take here is that I guess we should link this in the show notes. Nico Matsakis had this blog post on view types, which tries to get at this kind of idea of being able to write a method that takes self but only needs to have access to certain fields, so that you could call it from another method that has self but is already borrowing a disjoint set of fields. Which is something that'll be nice to get down the road, but as Ben says, like this is not. We're not quite there yet. Even though this is a quality of life improvement, it's tackling a slightly different problem.
Yeah, it is in the kind of vein of making the borrow checker more precise. And even though it's not like technically part of the borrow checker code base, any time that Rust creates an implicit reference, that's still going to be, you know, the users will experience errors with the borrow checker if things don't work out. So this is kind of like, you know, on the path of making the borrow checker a bit better in many cases. And previously, you could work around this too, this disjoint capture issue, by manually taking a reference to whatever field you wanted in a new binding and then, you know, closing over that binding in the closure. This kind of just makes that pattern more implicit, or, you know, not necessary anymore, less verbose. And that's kind of the general pattern for in C++, what you might call a capture clause, where you can say, you know, all the things I'm capturing, I'm closing over in this closure, I want to take this by reference and this by move, etc. Rust doesn't have those. Rust just, you know, just mostly infers everything that you want. And it mostly works out really good. Only in these kind of like edge cases does it not work out. So this just makes it a bit less necessary for Rust to even have capture clauses at all. But who knows if we'll have it in the future. There's still, again, like the view types kind of thing are kind of like capture clauses, although not on closures, obviously, on method fields. But we'll see. Who knows? Someday in the future, maybe.
The next step is one that we've talked about before, which is the implementation of into iterator, the trait for arrays. And this is something that you can already do in the current edition, as in the previous edition, so 2018. Into iterator can be used on arrays, but it works. It only works because of this little hack we talked about last time. And what's going to happen in the 2021 edition is that hack will be removed, and there'll just be a straight up implementation of into iterator for arrays that will iterate over them by value and not by reference. So it's really just sort of tidying up that shall we call it, oddity from the previous edition, where this kind of worked and also kind of didn't.
Yeah, we spoke at length about this in the previous podcast, and we won't go over it too much. I think it is worth pointing it out as kind of a feature of the editions where, I think people might misunderstand the edition system where you might think, oh, the old edition doesn't get new things. It's kind of like, you know, you might imagine it's like being like on an old version of the compiler where you just don't stop getting new things. It's not it at all, actually. So old editions still get all the new stuff that they can, which is pretty much everything. There's only a few things that old editions can't generally get. And so in this case, at around 52, sometime earlier this year, I think it was that version, somewhere around there. Every edition of Rust got the ability to use intuitor on arrays and in a most context. There was only one context where you couldn't, and it was a pretty important context, which is in the for loops. And now with the new edition has just uniformly everywhere across the board the ability to use intuitor on arrays. Old editions are kind of they're full featured mostly with a bit and if a bit inconsistent, whereas the new edition is totally consistent in its ability to use this intuitor on arrays. And so it's kind of an example of how you don't need to lock people on old editions out of getting new things. You can still give them new things even if nice isn't, you know, the most nice or consistent form of those things.
The next one I thought is worth a little bit more discussion. So this is around OR patterns and macro rules. So if you write a macro rules defined macro, so a declarative macro in your code, and one of the arguments you try to take is using the fragment specifier type PAT for pattern. It used to be in past editions that this would not match OR patterns. So if you have like A or B, whereas in this new edition, they will match A or B. And the reason for this was that in the old editions, you could only use A or B at the top level of a pattern. So if you write match foo, in that first, like the top level of the arm, you could say like sum one or sum two, but you couldn't in the past write sum one or two, where the one or two is inside of the sum. And therefore, it wasn't right for the macro pattern type to include ORs, because it would mean that the user might give you a pattern that contains an OR, but the macro might put it in a place where it sort of ends up being a sub pattern where OR isn't allowed. But now, because Rust, since I think 1.53, now supports OR inside of nested patterns as well, it was realized in the 2021 edition, we should just make it so that the PAT fragment specifier type in macros just includes ORs as well, so that all macros that mention these patterns allow users to use the full power of pattern matching. And then there's sort of a specific version of it called, PAT name? Is that what they've used? Let me double check. PAT param, it's called, that matches only the part without ORs. And so this is one example where if you move your crate from 2018 to 2021, you want to make sure that any macro rules you have that allow patterns as arguments, that you are actually okay with the patterns including ORs. Because in the 2021 edition, they will now do so by default, which is almost always what you want. Another change in the 2021 edition is that the cargo feature resolver now defaults to version 2 of the resolver. We talked about version 2 of the resolver a while back. So this was in, I think, Rust 151, that we talked about how cargo now has this new feature resolver. And the new feature resolver tries to ensure that crates only get compiled with the features that they need in the closure that they need.
The closure that they need?
Sorry, in the dependency closure that they mean. So what I'm thinking of is something like dev dependencies and build dependencies, for example, which are in the past, cargo would unify the features across dependency between the two, even though that's not necessarily what you want. The new resolver will make sure to only use the features that are declared in a given dependency block. So like for your normal dependencies, your dev dependencies, your build dependencies, the feature sets will be kept different for dependencies, even though they happen to be used in multiple of them, which might mean that a dependency gets compiled more than once, but it also means that you only get the features that you actually asked for in that closure, which has some implications for things like embedded workloads where something might not even compile under a given target, but it would be work fine as a build dependency, for example, if a feature was enabled. We talked about this at length back in the 151 episode, so I recommend going back and reading that if you're, or listening to that if you're curious about it. But that's at least now on by default in Rust 2021.
Up next, there are some new additions to the prelude. So in Rust, there is a thing called the prelude. It is essentially, imagine you're writing a Rust program, and if you ever wondered where, say, vec comes from or option comes from, they're available to you. You can write, you know, fn main, you know, let v equals vec new, or you can say, you know, let x equals sum, etc. And it just works. You don't need to have a use statement saying, you know, like use std, etc., vec, or option. And that all is provided by something called the prelude, and it is just a few hand-picked, extremely essential items, so traits, functions, macros, and types, that want to be available by default. And adding things to the prelude usually doesn't take much ceremony. There are already namespacing rules in Rust that make it so that if, say, someone adds a thing to the prelude and it clashes with a thing that you already defined in your own crate, then your own crate just wins. There's no real problem there. The problem with adding traits specifically, though, is that it might introduce a method on a trait that clashes with one of your own methods on a similar named trait. And then that might make it so that calling a method might become ambiguous, which might stop code from compiling. You wouldn't get like a confusing method thing. It would, you know, at runtime, it wouldn't, you know, pick one at random. It would just say, hey, I can't compile anymore. I'm not sure what you mean here. Please use the extremely verbose, explicit syntax to tell me which trait method you want to call in this case. And so that means that to add a trait to the prelude, you do need to do it over an addition. And so the specific traits that have been added in the new addition are try into, try from, and from iterator. John, do you want to talk about those first two?
Sure. So try into and try from are, as their name implies, fallible versions of the into and from trait. The idea here being that there are some types that can sometimes be converted into other types, but sometimes that conversion might fail. The obvious example here is parsing, right? So if you have a string, you can maybe turn it into a number if it happens to contain a valid number, but it might also fail. Like, you can think of try into and try from as being the generic versions of something like the from str trait, which takes a string and or takes any type that can be converted from a string fallibly. And try from and try into were stabilized a long time ago, but it used to be that you had to explicitly bring them into scope in order to use them, which meant that people just didn't use them that much or didn't even know that they existed. But now that they're in the prelude, it'll be a lot easier to just like type dot try into or dot try from, usually combined with a question mark operator, to do these conversions very straightforwardly.
As for the last one there, from iterator, it is one half of a pair. So into iterator is the other side of from iterator. Into iterator is the trait that controls how for loops work. And so if your type implements into iterator, then you can use it with for loops natively. From iterator is kind of the opposite, where mostly you would only encounter from iterator as part of the collect method. So if you have an iterator chain of things, and then you call collect on the end, under the hood that is using from iterator to do all the magic. And collect doesn't really match very often. And so, but you don't need from iterator in scope just to collect things. It's because collect is already a method on iterators, which is already in scope, the iterator trait. In the prelude, I mean. And so you might ask yourself, like, why is this necessary? Well, I guess, you know, you could say it's kind of just for neatness because inter-iterator is already in the prelude. Although a bit more concrete use case is if you're mapping over something, if you want to say, you know, I want to map over this thing that's an iterator, you can just map over, say, like the first, like using first class functions, you can say, you know, vec colon colon from iter, as opposed to having to say, you know, make a closure x and then call x.collect on that closure. So that's a bit nicer.
Yeah, it's true. The next one is something that I know you've been a little bit involved with, and I think we should combine the next two, which is that panic macros now always expect format strings, just like println, and that there's now reserved syntax for custom identifiers before the pound symbol. So think of something like raw strings, like R, pound, and then double quoted strings. Identifiers followed or immediately preceding a string. Think of something like byte strings. So if you type B and then double quotes, what you get back is a U8 slice. And same thing for identifier preceding a character literal. So this would be something like B single quote X single quote, which gives you a U8 instead of a character. Do you want to talk about these two and how they interact?
Yeah, I'll talk about this. So let's back up real quick. There is something coming up in an upcoming version of Rust, which we can preview right now. It is called implicit formatting captures. So the idea is currently, if you're writing, like, say, a println macro, and you want to just, like, you have a string hello and a string foo, and you want to put them together, you might type println, and then you have to give your thing in quotes, your format specifier, your format string, really. And so it would be, you know, open quote, bracket, open bracket, close bracket, comma, open bracket, close bracket, you know, comma, or, you know, quote again. And then you, after this, it's hard to code in voice, actually.
Yeah, I know, you're right.
The point is that in your print line, after you had your string of how you want to print it, you would need to say your two variables. Like, you have the string hello in a variable foo and the string world in a variable bar. You would have to end the print line invocation with comma foo comma bar, and that tells the print line macro what to put in your brackets individually. And this is kind of a shorthand, in fact. And so I think people are probably familiar with the brackets in the formatting strings syntax, where you can put a colon, and you can put like colon question mark, or you can put colon pound question mark, or if you're formatting integers or floats, there's all kinds of like various ways you can say, like, I want to, you know, add some white space here. I want you to pad this thing. I want you to round this thing to the, you know, this many decimal points, etc. So there's a whole language for the format strings, but people don't realize that that colon that starts all of these invocations actually is a separator. And before the colon, you can put exactly which variable you want to capture, or, you know, to format in that one bracket. And so, but implicitly, it just, you know, it's an index counting from 0 to 1, and it'll say, you know, the first one goes in the first bracket you find, second one goes in the second bracket you find. And you could explicitly put, you know, 0 or 1, or you could put, like, you know, you could have, you could print the same variable 4 times, put, you know, 0, 0, 0, 0 inside the brackets, and that's how it'll work. Alternatively, even more obscurely in this syntax, you could give each individual variable to print its own little ID. So in my aforementioned println invocation, I could say, like, x equals foo, y equals bar, at the end of the println macro. And then I could use X and Y inside the braces to refer to the individual variables to be printed. And it's a bit verbose, which is why it doesn't really get used very often. If you're doing like really involved format strings, it could be useful. This explanation is useful to demonstrate what's actually happening here under the hood now with this new feature called implicit formatting captures, which is nowadays on current nightly. It's got merged like last week or so. If you just say print line and then like quote bracket X bracket quote, and that's like the entire invocation, it will try to find a variable called X in your scope. And if it finds it, it'll print that. And so nowadays, if you're like, you know, used to format strings from other languages, the formatting facilities from, say, Python or JavaScript, this is how it normally works. So you don't need to, you know, redundantly say the name of the variable you want to format. You just like mention the name inside the format string, and then the language will find it for you. And that's how it will work in Rust in the future, where it will implicitly, if there's no reference to, hey, I have no idea what X is, it will reach out in this running scope and find X and then insert that. And so
it's going to be absolutely magical.
It's going to be extremely magical. People have wanted this for a long time, kind of like, because Rust is like, it's extremely explicit, but maybe a bit too much. Rust kind of always errs inside of being explicit. And people are kind of like, well, this is kind of a bridge too far. And it is kind of naturally how macros work. But println itself is not the most, not the least magical macro, let's say that. It's kind of involved. And so this is kind of the minimum that you could do to kind of like approximate the format string facilities from usually dynamic languages do this. So like, you know, JavaScript, Python, which many people are familiar with. And so that'll appeal to people used to that. But there is a bit further that you could go with this. And now I'm going to kind of like get into the realm of speculation, because this reserved syntax for this feature for now in Rust 2021, this would allow you to put any kind of arbitrarily, it would allow the language developers to put any arbitrary identifier in front of strings or character literals, etc. And this would allow them to consider adding, say, like an F specifier. Whereas John was mentioning, you could put like today, you can put like an R for a raw string or a B for a byte string. Nowadays, those are no longer like special cased, and now every possible letter or combination of letters is reserved for future language development. And so you can imagine one day, maybe there would be, say, like an F string to kind of match Python 3's F string syntax, where you can just say F and then a quotation mark, and then you could say whatever, and then close quotation mark, and it'll just automatically create a formatted thing for you. And obviously this is Rust, so you don't necessarily want, say, to allocate like many strings would do. It would be a bit more involved than that. It would probably create an arguments type, which is a kind of an internal type from the format module in std. And so there's a lot of details and kinks to work out before any of this could happen. But this reservation just makes it possible to consider someday having this feature. There's still a lot to consider, especially with regard to the actual syntax, because in Python, one of the things is that you can write any expression inside the format string. You could do calculations, you could call methods and functions and anything you want. And whereas the newly stabilized implicit captures just lets you write identifiers. You can't even do like no field accesses. There's no like indexing allowed. It's just identifiers. And so it demands to be seen whether or not people want to extend that to full expressions or some subset of expressions. These are all things that would need to be figured out before F strings could even be considered. And so it'll be a while before you kind of get feedback from users on how they're using it. Like, we'll see whether people are eager to move their print line statements over to format, the new format implicit captures, and their feedback on whether or not it's sufficient for their use cases. So we'll see. This syntax kind of just opens the door for this in the future. And the reason that it had to be an addition is because of macros can kind of parse Rust these days in kind of like limited ways. And so theoretically, this could break some macros. So that's why it had to be in addition. And then as for the panic change that kind of comes along with this, the idea of this new implicit formatting feature is that it should work on anything under the hood that uses the format args macro, which is what println uses and assert eek underneath uses. All kinds of macros use this. And so if you have a macro today that uses internally this, then you will get this feature for free whenever this stabilizes in like two or three releases. But panic was kind of this was an oversight back at 1.0. A single argument panic had a different kind of a code path than usual. It didn't go through format args machinery. It kind of just did a thing. And so it was a unique little snowflake. And so that has been melted. And now it has been made more consistent. But because I could break things, it's only more consistent in the new edition.
Yeah, I'm so excited to see this like making progress and towards landing. I thought some of the other proposals for reserved syntax, what it could be used for, is nice too. Like, you could imagine having like K pound keyword allow you to create identifiers by the same name as a keyword in Rust. Stuff like that, I think, could be neat too.
Yeah, that would be useful for, so I think in the previous edition, in the 2018 edition, for example, one of the edition changes was to reserve various keywords. And many keywords were reserved in advance of them actually being used, kind of just like, you know, aspirationally, like async and kind of thing. So if you, say, had the ability to put K pound, which you do now with this new reserve syntax for an identifier, it would allow you to quote-unquote reserve identifiers without the need for an addition. So it makes it easier to prototype and to potentially get things in the hands of users, and then an addition would then be able to go through and, you know, get rid of that K pound on front of it. So kind of a, you can imagine it's kind of a beta version of identifiers. So that's kind of one of the proposals. There's plenty of things that we can talk about here. I wrote the RFC for this, so I could go on for ages about the things that we could do here, but they're all very provisional. I don't want to get people's hopes up, because really it's just...
Well, you have my hopes up now, so...
Oh, no.
So now you're going to disappoint me, Ben.
Inevitably, like I always do.
The last one is it's not a big change, but it is one that's worth noting as far as what editions are for, which is there are two warnings that have been promoted to errors in this edition. Bare trait objects. So this is something like if you have a box of mitrate, that is no longer legal. That now has to be box din mitrate. There are lots of reasons why this became a warning in the first place, but the reason it's becoming an error now, and the same is true for the other warning, ellipsis inclusive range patterns, which is the triple dot syntax for inclusive ranges, which has been deprecated for a while and should be replaced with dot dot equals. Both of these warnings have existed for a long time and are really intended to... or when they initially landed, were intended to signal this will be removed in the future. And we just want to give people like as long as we can to sort of adapt to this change. And because it would be a breaking change to make them errors within an addition, we use the addition mechanism to also have these kind of deprecations actually take effect. Because the underlying machinery is the same, right? If you write box mitrate, it can compile to the same code as box din mitrate. So it's only really the syntax that changes, and therefore we can turn it into an error at an addition boundary because the addition boundary is explicitly opt-in anyway. I don't think there are any warnings of this kind that are specifically being proposed right now for the 2021 edition. But it's more that as we accumulate new warnings and deprecations and stuff, the edition boundary allows us to actually do that hard deprecation as part of that move.
Yeah, the policy towards warnings is interesting in terms of... I think it's evolved a bit since the previous edition. So the idea of this edition has not actually made anything. I don't think it's added any new warnings of the same type where they will eventually become errors. Rust already has a facility for turning a warning into an error that isn't on an edition. And sometimes this is required because the Rust stability policy still allows breakage in the cases of like unsoundness or like just obvious wrongness. And obviously, even though it's allowed, it doesn't mean people want to like cause that kind of disruption. And so the idea is to minimize disruption. And sometimes people are say, you know, use an addition. Sometimes people say, you know, just do it. And just doing it means using a facility called the future incompatibility warnings. And this is kind of a newer thing where imagine you're writing some Rust code or using a dependency. Dependencies might have warnings in them. But by default, if you're compiling with cargo, it won't show you, it'll just kind of squelch all the warnings that a dependency will give you. Because, you know, it figures like you don't actually have control of it in terms of like, you don't malapplying the code. So like, don't worry about it. It isn't your problem. If, say, some warning became an error in the future, that would cause your code to stop compiling when you upgraded your compiler, which is your problem. And so the idea is that this class of warnings called future incompatibility warnings will kind of pierce the veil and will be shown to you if you're using a crate that has them. This is kind of a newer thing in cargo. I'm not sure if it's like really being used yet.
Yeah, I think we mentioned this briefly last time too, because that's when they mentioned that future compatibility lints would start to be used.
Yeah, so... these obviously get used sparingly because of the potential for breakage. And so Rust has very good infrastructure for detecting breakage in terms of running tests against the entire library of code on crates.io, which is an incredibly involved process. It takes like days and days, but it's extremely good at finding a secret breakage from any feature, and it gets run all the time on every Rust release. So it ideally would only be used for things that would have almost no impact, and that would, you know, have very big like security impact, say, like, you know, if there's some kind of unsoundness in something. It's kind of, I think, subsumed the idea of doing these kind of warnings to errors and additions, unless they could still do it if they wanted to. But I don't recall that this edition has actually added any new warnings of this kind. And like I was saying before, where, you know, over time editions, we would expect them to become, you know, as the rough edges of Rust get smoothed over, fewer things need to be in them. So maybe it's just that this time there was nothing that needed that kind of treatment. So
yeah, although I still feel like there was a decent amount of good stuff that landed in this edition too. But I think you're right that over time we should expect editions to get smaller in scope. Mm-hmm. I want to mention one thing. So those are sort of the big changes in the edition, but I want to mention the cargo fix tool, which I think many people don't really know about or don't really know what it does. So cargo fix is a great way to have cargo update your code when cargo knows how it needs to be updated. And in particular, it has a dash dash addition flag that you can pass to make cargo walk through your code base and make any changes that it can like do automatically to move you to the new addition. So this would be stuff like if it realizes that you're like manually including try into, for example. I don't know if that's particular one is one that it supports, but it's this kind of stuff where cargo fix edition can just make any manual changes that you would be required to if you were to adopt the new edition. It's a great tool that's worth knowing about and looking into.
And that finishes off the edition related things. You want to get into the new features on every edition 1.56?
Always. I love these. So one big one is cargo now has a Rust version field in the package section of cargo toml. And this is something that's sort of been on the table for a while. And there's been a lot of sort of bike shedding on what the name should be, but also some more fundamental questions about what the semantics should be. The basic idea here is that you can declare in your Rust version field the minimum supported Rust version for that crate. And the reason why you want to do this is primarily to give your consumers better error messages. So currently, if someone takes a dependency on you and you make a change that requires a newer version of the compiler, then what that dependent crate will see if someone compiles it is there'll just be some hard to understand compiler error. Like it might be
if they're on an old version of the compiler.
If they use an old version of the compiler, exactly, then they might see something like, oh, this function doesn't exist, or this addition doesn't exist, or this feature isn't stable, but has been stabilized in the version that you were using when you published that dependency. Whereas if you add this Rust version declaration in your cargo toml, then when you or your crate gets built using an older version of the compiler, that compiler can just say, I'm not new enough to compile this crate, and therefore you need to update the compiler in order to compile it. And that's a much more helpful user message because it actually tells them what went wrong and what version they have to update to. Now, it's worth noting that there are some caveats to this feature. The first and most obvious one is that because support for Rust version was only added in Rust 156, there is no point setting Rust version to a value lower than 156 because a lower version wouldn't know about the field in the first place. The second caveat is that the Rust version field does not feed into Cargo's dependency resolver. So if someone is using an old version of the compiler and they take a dependency on your crate that has declared a Rust version, Cargo won't pick like the latest version that's still compatible with their compiler version. It'll just pick the latest version that matches the semantic versioning specifier. And then if that doesn't compile with their version, it'll give them an error. This may or may not change in the future. It's a little unclear because we do want to incentivize people to upgrade, and we don't want them to sort of just transparently get an old version and not know that they're running on an old version. So there's some subtlety there. There's another third caveat with this, which is that remember that if you declare a Rust version in your cargo TOML, but you have dependencies, then that Rust version might actually be invalidated by a change to your dependencies. So imagine that you declare Rust version 156, and then one of your dependencies suddenly requires a feature from Rust 157 and upgrades their Rust version. Then now your crate lists Rust version equals 156, but actually requires Rust 157 because of a dependency. There's not really a good mechanism for enforcing something like this at the moment. Partially because most crates don't really stick to a given minimum versioning sort of schedule. And this is a somewhat hard, but also somewhat orthogonal question that this doesn't try to tackle. This is mainly trying to get at, can we give you better errors when a dependency requires a newer version of the compiler than you have? There's still unresolved issues like the ones we've talked about, but at least this is a step up in terms of the user experience here.
Yeah, I mean, so just as a notable example, so for example, the regex crate from Andrew Gallant and Burton Sushi, that supports all Rust versions of 1.41 or greater currently. So if you are, that's kind of like one of the more thoughtful versioning. So like that crate kind of like sets the standard for, does regex support it in terms of like how old of a compiler, Rust compiler, does like a general, well-developed, well-maintained crate support. So NAT was released, what, June of last year? About. So you would think in the future that kind of like people have asked for, long-term support releases of Rust, and it's kind of been a thing of like what version should we support, and it always boils down to like what version ship with Debian, etc., and in various package managers. So this kind of is one step towards figuring out okay, like what is our policy, what should a thoughtful crate do for supporting old versions of Rust, because it is kind of hard because it means that you have to consciously not use features that are shiny and new. And for the sake of your users who don't want to upgrade or can't upgrade, and kind of like hold yourself back.
Yeah, it's definitely, I think, a part that the Rust ecosystem hasn't really figured out yet, in part because it is challenging once you take dependencies, because the dependencies are sort of out of your control, mm-hmm. unless you're willing to sort of hold back your dependencies and say, I don't depend on any 1.x version of my dependency. I depend on any version that's like 1.x, but less than or equal to 1.5 or whatever it might be, right? You need to constrain them because you don't know whether future versions will conform to the same Rust version requirements that you promise to your consumers. So it's a thorny situation that I think we're still navigating, but at least this provides a mechanism for declaring your intentions, which is a step forward.
Let's keep moving on. So the natural language feature this time, new bindings in binding at pattern, where at is the at sign. I think this is kind of one of the more obscure corners of the pattern syntax. And this is taken, I think, from just, it's from ML or Haskell or some language that supports patterns and has for a million years. It's kind of just one of those things you don't see very much in Rust. Maybe in those you see it more. But this allows you to bind an identifier to some pattern that you've already matched. And so this has been supported for a long time, but now you can have multiple identifiers bound in the same pattern, or like it's kind of complicated, but just know that now they all of the restrictions have been removed in terms of letting you write this identifier in various places. There are still some things about the values must peak copy, I think. In terms of actually make it work to avoid various ownership shenanigans. But it's a pretty cool feature. If you're into deep patterns, if you're really into like match statements, learn what the at symbol does and see if you can use it in your code.
Yeah, I've certainly found the at symbol handy. There are very limited cases where it comes in useful, but then it can really simplify your code structure, and it makes me happy. That now it's you can use at in more cases to like unlock that that way of writing patterns. Mm-hmm. I think we're then on to stabilized APIs. So this time there weren't too many sort of large ones that struck out to me. We got a bunch of shrink to methods. The idea here being that there's already shrink to fit for many collection types, for example, that reduces the heap allocation used to store something to the minimal size that it needs to be in order to contain its elements. So remember how vectors, for example, as you push to them, when they grow, they usually double in capacity. But that means that after you, if you know that you're done pushing to them, you might then have all the spare capacity at the end and you want to reduce your memory use so you can use shrink to fit. There's now shrink to, which takes an argument saying what capacity you want to shrink to. And that seems like a nice sort of quality of life improvement for those cases where you want finer control over how much memory you actually use. And this does... this doesn't actually truncate the thing. Like it's sort of bound by or capped at the size, the length of the collection, but it is sort of a, now you have this option as well of shrinking to something that's not just the minimal fit. We also got buff writer into parts, which is really nice if you're using a buff writer for making your writes to your sort of IO writes more efficient. Then into parts actually lets you take a buff writer that you've written some stuff into and turn it back into the original writer that you had and any bytes that haven't been flushed yet, which is really nice if you're writing sort of low-level IO code. I think that's all I really wanted to mention there. We got some constifications, though. We got a constification of memtransmute. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Ben?
Oof, I want to mention it, but also I want to ask you if you know. So, okay, obviously transmute is kind of one of the granddaddies of unsafe code in terms of what it allows you to do is just totally break type safety if you're not careful, which can itself trivially break memory safety. So you have to be extremely careful using this function. But now it works in const context, or rather, before now, it worked only in const and static contexts. Now it works also in const.fn. And so this means that it's possible to obviously use it wrong because it's an unsafe code. But do you know what unsafe code does at compile time if you use it wrong in terms of like what is undefined behavior actually defined to do at compile time?
Yeah, so this is really interesting. Like what does compile time undefined behavior actually mean? And it is actually something that we're sort of still trying to figure out what the implications of that are. And I don't think we have a great solution or a great answer to that question yet. Apart from if you have undefined behavior at compile time, it basically means your runtime code can end up being whatever. Like it's not just that the runtime behavior can change from that point on, but you don't even know that the code you end up with will actually be representative of the code that was written in the program. Like you don't know if the compilation will be correct.
Yeah, the code will still be wrong, obviously. Like the rest of them actually like fix it for you or make it not undefined behavior or not totally bananas. But I think that we should, you know, emphasize that it's not going to like corrupt your compiler process. That's like one of the things that they do say about this, where it's like, even though it's undefined behavior, it's not going to make the compiler go astray. It's not going to like, you know, it's not an attack vector on you yourself if you're compiling code at const.fn that invokes an undefined behavior. And even in many cases, the expectation is that it will be able to catch the undefined behavior and then issue an error, although it does not guarantee that. So the const engine named Miri does do its best to detect undefined behavior whenever it finds it, but obviously it can't guarantee it. If it can guarantee it, we wouldn't need to worry about unsafe blocks in the first place.
Yep. So. Yeah, it's a really interesting sort of intermediate stage of undefined behavior that I think currently you should think of as if you invoke undefined behavior at compile time, what code actually ends up in your binary may not represent the code that's in your code, in your source files. Mm-hmm. The two just, the moment you invoke undefined behavior, you're sort of telling the compiler, you can optimize based on whatever assumptions you want, and I don't care whether, or I don't even now get the guarantee that the code is actually correct. Or accurate, maybe, is a better representation of that.
One more library API thing to mention in this release is the implementation of from, so for all of the collections in std, so HashMap, et cetera, they now implement from an array of tuples, or from an array, and sometimes from an array of tuples for things that make sense, like this. And so essentially, if you've ever written, or if you've ever written a vec before, if you've ever made a vec before, you'll be familiar with the vec macro. So like just vec, exclamation point, and then square bracket, 1, 2, 3, square bracket, makes a vec of 1, 2, 3. And this is equivalent to vec, colon, colon, from, and then the argument to from could be a fixed size array of like 1, 2, 3. So that both that vec macro and that from implementation have kind of been exclusive to vec for a long time, even though vec is only one of a few collections in std. And so people have asked for a long time for a nicer way to construct or initialize many collections. And so, for example, let's just use hash maps. Like everything I say for hash maps will be true for everything else too, where if you want to make a hash map these days, before this change, you would say, let mute x equals hash map new, and then you would say x dot insert like 1, 2, 3, 4, etc. Or x dot insert 1, 2, and then the next line x dot insert 1, 3, 4, and so you need to have one insert one like insert command for every element that you wanted to have in this initialized hash map. There was no real nice kind of like one shot constructor for a hash map before now, and people have theorized, let's just have like a hash map macro, and I'm sure you can find macros for this on Chris.io. But there's always the question of what should the syntax be? Because every other language has their own syntax for hash map constructors, and then people get bogged down in bike shedding forever. And it's kind of just like, let's just, for now, instead of having to worry about syntax, let's just give all these collections a from impl. And so the idea is currently today, you can already collect into these hash maps. Collect into a hash map from an array of tuples. And so in this case, this lets you just construct the hash map outright from an array. So it's kind of a nicer way. It's kind of a half measure towards having a first-class constructor for hash maps. And so now you would say, instead of having, let mute x equals hash map new, and then inserting various lines, you would say, let x equals hash map colon colon from, and then you would say square bracket, and then a tuple 1, 2, comma, tuple 3, 4, comma, tuple 5, 6, and square bracket. So it's a fair bit nicer. It's one of those nice quality of life things. And that applies for every collection these days. And that doesn't mean that there won't be maybe someday some kind of macro for making it nicer. But honestly, ever since
this gets pretty close,
it gets pretty close, and ever since const generics became powerful enough to have the from impl on vec, like I mentioned before, I've honestly been preferring that. I don't know. I kind of I don't have anything against macros, but I tend to gravitate towards functions whenever I don't strictly need a macro for things.
Yeah, they also get formatted more nicely by Rust format in general.
Yeah, and it's also kind of just with IDEs, it works a bit nicer to use methods instead of macros in terms of like easier for them to type check and present errors and that kind of things. So
that's true.
Yeah. So
I had a couple of other things from the changelog too. So one of them, and if you read through this, you might read this and go like, what does that even mean? Which is, there's an entry there that says, remove p unpin bound on impl future for pin. and this is a PR that I filed, that I actually filed while writing Rust for your stations, because there's a section in there where I talk about like pin and why the various bounds are and what unpin means. And then I got to this, the fact that there's an implementation of the future trait for the pin type. And there's a bound on there saying that P, like this impl future for pin P, had a bound that said where P is unpin. And I just couldn't articulate why that bound was necessary when writing the book. I just, from all I knew about this stuff, like that just didn't make sense to me. And after thinking about it for a long time, I came to the conclusion that this must not be necessary. And so I filed a PR and no one else could find that it was necessary either. And so now this bound has been removed. I don't think anyone cares about this implementation. It's like very much of a weird niche corner. But if you're really curious about pin and unpin, it's one that I recommend you go look at and sort of look at the discussion and the documentation for why this is correct, because it is an interesting insight into how these weird pieces fit together.
On a personal note too, I do want to mention that bullet point and the previous one, the impl from array for collections, those are both hidden away in the detailed release notes. They didn't make it to the actual blog post. And in fact, those two were written by yours truly. Both you wrote this one and I wrote the previous one. So I want to say, I think there's an agenda against us.
I think you're right. I think
trying
that
to silence us.
We're not part of some kind of cabal that we should be part of.
The Rust Illuminati.
Yeah, exactly. I want to be part of these backroom dealings for setting up the release notes.
Mm-hmm.
There's another really cool, low level, change that landed at 156, which is, an improvement to instant backsliding protection. And here we need to rewind and give a little bit of context. So the standard time instant type in Rust guarantees that it is monotonic. That is, if you take an instant and then later on in your code, you take another instant, the duration between them is always going to be positive. So it's always going that the value underlying the instant is always going to go up. And normally you would sort of assume that this was guaranteed by whatever underlying mechanism the operating system or the platform provided. But of course, many of them have bugs and do not actually guarantee this behavior. Like for example, on x86 systems, on Windows, on AR64 systems and a couple of others, like particular versions of the Linux kernel on particular hardware. There's like just a bunch of cases where this is just not true. Like you can take an instant and then take another instant and the newer instant has a lower value. And for this reason, the Rust standard library includes this thing called backsliding protection, which is basically, if it detects that it has an implementation that can sort of slide backwards in time, it forces the new value to be newer than the old one so that code can rely on this guarantee. And the way it does that used to be through a mutex. So if it detected that the current platform has this kind of backsliding property, then it would take an instant and then grab a mutex to check that the value was newer than the last value it gave out. Of course, mutexes experience contention. So this would cause some pretty serious performance degradations for any application that just like takes a bunch of instants and looks at the time. And so what landed in 156 was an improvement that moves this from being a mutex to being an atomic U64, which has much less contention and doesn't actually block at any time. It doesn't have the same kind of contention experience. And so this is going to be potentially a pretty large performance improvement for performance-sensitive applications that do have to deal with time, which is basically all of them, because they use it for things like profiling and logging. Like it comes up so much that I'm very excited to see this land. And I think there are probably like production customers out there that are like, this is going to significantly matter to our use case.
One last thing from the detailed release notes here is that the LLVM 13 upgrade happened in 1.56. And that mostly brought a bunch of things that are in the weeds we won't talk about in terms of improvements. I'm sure there's plenty of performance improvements and compile time improvements. One of the bigger things that came with LLVM 13, though, is called the new pass manager. And this has the potential for a lot of a lot better compile times for various LLVM projects. And it's actually not enabled right now. Some bugs were discovered a bit after enabling it that had to do with recursively mutually recursive functions getting inlined exponentially. So that's currently still being worked on an LLVM side. But once it finally gets enabled, it should have a pretty noticeable performance improvement. And a pass manager, essentially, just LLVM as a compiler, as a backend, it does a bunch of little passes for simplifying code in various ways. And like one pass might happen, the next pass happens on the after the previous pass. And the new pass manager essentially just has better caching and lazy behavior. And we'll link to a blog post from LLVM talking about the details, because it's a bit over my head, essentially.
I have one very last bit too, which is if you care about like build systems or like the configuration of cargo, the cargo configuration files, so whether that's in home/.cargo/config or in .cargo/config, now has an environment variable section. So you can now have cargo set environment variables for you in the configuration. This might be helpful for like setting OpenSSL dir or something everywhere in your project or in any cargo project that you build if you have a particularly like weird deployment setup. It's just like a neat quality of life improvement for the people who need to configure cargo and don't want to have to do it like all over the place in lots of configuration files. That's now supported directly by cargo. I think with that, we can move to 156.1. And this was a security release that came about from a CVE that spanned much beyond Rust. So this is CVE 2021-42574. And this CVE was all about Unicode code points that affect rendering of code. And it's a problem that actually hit a lot of projects, not just related to Rust code. Like this affected Python, Node.js, Go, like basically everywhere. And the basic vulnerability is that there are Unicode code points that allow bidirectional overrides for text. So this is something where you can put a sort of Unicode code point in a piece of, say, UTF-8 encoded text that reverses the direction of text. And then you could do it again. And what this allows is that if you have something that renders code, you can have the code contain a Unicode code point that sort of makes the next text be written backwards over what was already written, and then you reverse direction again and you write some different text over it. And there's some good examples in the security advisory that we can put out, but this means that a malicious attacker can like make code that looks like it says one thing when you look at it in an editor, but the actual code when compiled and executed does something completely different. And of course, this is not actually related to Rust. This is more about how code is rendered and how it might be rendered in a way where like a security audit of the code, if someone reads the code, it looks fine, but what actually gets compiled and runs is malicious somehow. But what the Rust project did was they implemented a lint in the compiler that is deny by default, that basically yells at you if any source file contains any of these potentially problematic code points. Now, this doesn't solve the problem, right? You can still just opt out of this lint entirely, for example. But what it does do is at least give you sort of a warning sign if there is some code that contains this. That doesn't help you if the code is, for example, on GitHub and you're just reading through it, which is why this CVE was so widespread in the community. Like GitHub as well posted that they have addressed this vulnerability by adding a little warning flag at the top of all source files shown on GitHub that contain these code points. So it's just an interesting attack vector where the Rust mitigation is really just giving you a sort of lint for this, but it's not really a Rust problem, but at least the compiler can do what it can do a little bit to try to ease or mitigate the problem.
And to emphasize too, the big concern is like comments mostly, because you need to be in a context where you can put arbitrary Unicode characters, which doesn't happen in many places. So comments are the big deal here. Although Rust does now support Unicode identifiers, and I'm not sure if I think some of these characters are allowed in Unicode identifiers. Rust does not support the full gamut of Unicode as an identifier, unlike say Swift. You can't do an emoji function name, that kind of thing. But Rust, ever since the original release of Unicode identifiers, it has always linted very aggressively against extremely strange things like this. So any kind of confusables or mixed scripts, it has a bunch. It's like maybe like four at least lints individually checking for this kind of thing. So I know people are always worried, and you should be, but Rust takes it pretty seriously.
Yeah, and I think the Unicode standard actually has a sort of a section on identifiers and how you should vet identifiers and how you should what subset of the Unicode symbol table you should allow in identifiers. And I think Rust follows that very closely. I know there was a lot of discussion when Unicode identifiers were stabilized on what rules exactly should we follow. But I think Rust ends up doing something very sensible there, and that probably reduced the impact of this particular CVE on Rust code too.
All right, and let's move on to our final of four releases today, Rust 1.57.
It's very exciting. It's also odd, you know, because
it is odd.
Yeah.
It's extremely odd, although next time, probably less odd, the next release. Also, it's a much less impactful than 56. We won't spend an entire hour talking just about this one.
Yeah, that's probably true. Although there are some really cool changes in there. I'm excited to see this release too. Mm-hmm. So the first thing here is panic and const contexts. Do you want to talk a little bit about this, Ben?
Yeah, sure. So the panic macro is now usable in constfn. And so you might wonder what it's useful for. Well, and what it's actually really great for creating your own compiler errors. I'm pretty sure that's it'll like just hook into the compiler error machinery. And if you panic in a const, you can now kind of do a custom compiler error. I'm not sure if that's the ideal way of doing it. That might be like a more like, you know, first class way of doing it, but as quick and easy compiler error, that's the new hotness. And this also allows you to use the assert macro in const context, which is pretty important in general. I say more important than panic for writing code. Although we should mention it's not yet allow assert eq, the assert underscore eq macro, because assert eq under the hood uses formatting code, and the formatting code has not yet been made const. And so and in particular the panic macro that it works in const context only allows certain forms that don't include formatting.
Yeah, and this is also why unwrap and expect don't work, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So working towards making const code be pretty equivalent to non-const code. Now, you know, unwrap and expect are pretty important for that, although we're getting there.
Yeah, and I think maybe one way to frame this particular thing is that there are a bunch of things that internally use panic that we would like to make const, and a sort of requirement for that is to make panic itself usable in const. So this would be things like assert, which is now enabled, assert eq, which is not there yet. But there's also things like the to-do macro and the unreachable macro, which are also really just aliases for panic.
I love to-do, by the way, just like one of my favorite macros.
Yeah, it's pretty great.
What a good macro. I love it so much.
The next change in 157 is support for custom profiles in Cargo. So you might already know that Cargo has multiple compilation profiles. There are four that sort of come standard. There's dev, release, test, and bench that have slightly different configurations. Like, for example, dev includes debug info. Release includes more optimizations. Test includes the config test, among other things. And bench is like test, but with more optimizations. And now you can declare your own profile. So for the example they give in the release notes is that you might have a production profile that is like release, but it also uses link time optimization to like really squeeze out every last inch of performance from the binary. You can imagine having a profile that includes things like profile-guided optimization, or like you might have a profile that is like release mode but with debug info, or test but with release, with release optimizations. There's all sorts of interesting profiles you can imagine coming up with here. And at least now you have the machinery for doing so, rather than having to like modify the pre-existing profiles and being able to give them better names.
Up next, we have fallible allocation. So these are library APIs, which usually don't get their own section in the release notes, but these ones are pretty important because of what they kind of indicate for the broader direction of Rust getting used, and that is Rust in the Linux kernel. And so Linux kernel, obviously, famously, cares about not crashing, one of those things. And you might be wondering, well, what do these new APIs allow you to do? Why wouldn't I use these all the time in my code? And they're about memory allocation. And so the idea is very often when you write code, if you just like say like you make a vec, say, if you're like creating a vec and you want to push to it, that might involve reallocating the entire vector, which takes up more memory. And what happens when there is no more memory? For many applications, this question is entirely moot. The reason is that on many OSs, Linux and macOS both, the OS just lies to you about how much memory you have. It is extremely common for the OS to say, yes, I have memory, here you go, when in fact there is no memory backing it up. And it will kind of just like lazily give you memory as you request it, or it'll do shenanigans with like trying to compress memory if there is contention or, you know, too much stuff being given out. And so generally, if the OS lies to you, there's really nothing you can do. And so many application, so the Rust standard library just doesn't care, really. And so it'd say, hey, like it would be an extremely burdensome API requirement to require every single thing that could possibly fail to allocate memory to bubble that up to the user. And so if it happens, then we'll panic and just, oh, actually it'll abort, I believe, if that happens. But if you are in an environment where you can guarantee that the OS won't lie to you, for example, if you're writing an OS, then it's extremely useful to know that you are out of memory. And so this is not sufficient for Linux's use case, I believe. I haven't really read the proposal, but there was a long discussion. I'm not sure if it was a full RFC, but there have been many people involved with Linux and contributing to Linux kernel have talked about how, okay, we would like to see various things from standard library and Rust to guarantee that we could use even like, you know, libraries and from Microsoft.io and, you know, guarantee that they're not going to allocate or, you know, abort the process, you know, panic the kernel just because they failed to allocate some memory. So this is kind of maybe step one of that process. I'm sure there's much more to go. But so essentially, vec, string, hash map, hash set, and vecdq all have try reserve as a new function.
Yeah, one of the big missing parts here, I think, for the kernel is that they want to sort of statically guarantee at compile time that there's nothing in there that could panic because of out of memory, which this is a step in the right direction, but it doesn't solve the problem, right? There's nothing that prevents someone from writing dot push in the kernel without first calling try reserve. So there's still a question of how can we statically guarantee the things that the Linux kernel requires us to guarantee? And that's still being figured out. But at least now we have the startings of the mechanisms that the kernel can use, and other use cases too, like embedded use cases, can use when they do want to know whether an allocation succeeded or failed. We have a bunch of other stabilized APIs too, which are sort of less monumentous than try reserve. I think the first one I wanted to call out is command. Now, so this is standard process command, the thing you use if you want to spawn a process inside of a Rust program. So previously, it had like you do command :: new, you give a program name, and then you can add arguments, you can set the current directory, you can set environment variables, but you didn't have a way to inspect a given command before you execute it and look at what arguments it is being passed or what environment variables it is being passed. Whereas now it's gained a bunch of get functions. So there's get program, get args, get envs, and get current dir, which gives you the configuration of a command and lets you introspect it before you choose to actually execute the command. The other one that I think is pretty neat is that there is now a map while method on iterator. So the idea here is that it's sort of like filter map on option, or I guess not. There's a filter map on iterator too, where it will run each item through a closure, and the iterator will only yield the items for which the closure returns some and not the ones where it returns none. With map while, it's sort of similar, except that it will stop the first time it gets none. So it's like a take until, and then with a closure that when it returns none, it stops taking, and the closure also gets to map the item. So it's like another nice utility on iterator that makes it somewhat easier to write concise iterator sequences, especially if you're sort of trying to write your program in a somewhat functional style.
And constification continues unabated, this time with the unreachable unchecked function. And so essentially, unreachable unchecked is an unsafe function. It's a way of telling the Rust compiler, hey, here is a branch that can never be taken. And so, for example, if you had like an if statement where it's just literally if true, you could have an else branch with an unsafe, unreachable unchecked in there. And then that would tell the compiler, hey, this branch can't ever be reached. And that's kind of a useless example. But there's various examples where, for example, if Rust is requiring you to write a branch for something, like say that the value in an option is a sum. You've already verified it to yourself. Maybe you like made it yourself earlier up in the function. But Rust doesn't know that. It just sees an option. And so maybe it forces you to have a branch on there. If you want to use that branch and you wanted to put, you know, unsafe, bracket, unreachable, unchecked in there, that indicates to the optimizer that is a totally unreachable branch, and it should be optimized away, and that means that there won't be any kind of branch there at all in the final binary. Now, obviously, it's unsafe because you do have to manually ensure that you never get there, because if you get there, undefined behavior.
Yeah, because unlike unreachable, which panics, this does not include any panic machinery in that branch.
And so, yeah, so there's the unreachable macro, which is just, you know, it's great for indicating this, but also still being safe. And now this is a const function. And so nicely, it will give you a compiler error. So that's actually, it won't be undefined behavior at compile time, I'm pretty sure, right? Yeah. So Mary is smart enough that it will try to take the branch and it'll see, hey, it's compiler error. We've reached it. So it will give you a nice compiler error saying, hey, you messed up.
Yeah, assuming that it is being evaluated in const context, right? Mm-hmm. So if you have a const fn that includes this, then if that const fn is called from constant context, then hitting it will be a compiler error. But if you invoke it at runtime context, then it will be undefined behavior. Here too, we've done our usual thing of walking through the change logs. And I think one that struck me as particularly entertaining was the fact that vec leak no longer allocates. So you may be familiar with box leak. So box leak takes a box, an owned box, and returns you a tick static mutable reference to the underlying memory. And the intention here is that once you leak the value, it will never be dropped, and therefore the heap memory is just valid forever, so it can give you a static reference to it. And the same thing exists for vec, but with vec leak, what it would do is it would first shrink the allocation to be actually the size of the length of the array, not just its capacity, and then give you back a reference to that slice. Of course, this meant that it was a little weird to call vec leak because it did an allocation and a copy of the entire vector in order to move it into the smaller capacity. But now with this change, vec leak will do the sort of intuitive thing of keeping the whole memory allocation and still just giving you a reference to the slice of just the contents, which I thought was entertaining that it didn't do this in the past.
Similarly, the final item in my notes is that as of the new release, Rust now has a new tier 3 target of the Nintendo 3DS.
It's so great. I don't know why. I don't know why this was added, but it's...
Somebody wanted to write Rust on the 3DS, and they were like, you know what? Why not? Let's do it. And so we should mention, too, that the tier system, tier 1 are targets that get, like, you know, tested. Every single commit gets, like, the full test suite run on it. And so they're very well tested. Tier 2 is they are guaranteed to compile with every commit, but they or with every release, that is, but they won't run the full test suite. And then tier three is anything goes. Like, we'll add support for this if you really want us to, but it's up to you to make sure it works. there's no Nintendo 3DS test runner somewhere in someone's like kitchen, like hooked up the internet with like, you know, running random Rust code every release to make sure it still works.
It's very sad. We should definitely have a fleet of 3DSs.
We should.
Mm-hmm. I had a couple of more things. So in cargo, and this is actually a change that happened in 155, but didn't make the release notes, which is that cargo will no longer have Rust flags be set for build scripts. It used to be that if Rust flags was set in the environment, then cargo would just pass that through to build scripts. But it wasn't entirely reliable because if, for example, Rust flags was not set, but there were Rust flags set in the cargo configuration file through like build.rustflags, for example, those would not be set in Rust flags. So build scripts that relied on the Rust flags environment variable would actually get a sort of misleading value. Now, since 155 and announced now in 156, cargo will set a different environment variable called cargo encoded Rust flags, which is guaranteed to hold the current set of Rust flags that cargo is using, encoded in a way where like white space splitting and such isn't a problem, that build scripts can actually rely on. Another change that I thought was kind of neat is that there's been a lot of additions of the must use attribute to functions in the standard library. So I think we mentioned must use back when it first stabilized. The basic idea is that you add it to a function definition, and anyone who calls that function is required to do something with the return value. The idea being that, for example, if you have a function that has no side effects, it's a pure function, then calling it without looking at the return value is probably an error. An example of this might be saturating add on integers, which returns the result of doing the saturating add. It doesn't actually modify the value that you call saturating add on, and therefore not using the return value means that you're probably not doing what you think you're doing. And so it has a must use attribution. And a bunch of similar attributes were added in 156, like on the standard in, standard out, and standard error locks, on thread builder, on RC downgrade. There's a whole host of them. And I think this is just a really good way to just eliminate errors that are hard to spot when you just like look at the code briefly, and you really need to look at the signature. But here, the compiler can actually help you realize that this was wrong. I think there are like 800 attributes that were added to the standard library in this in 156, which is wild and really cool. I have two more that are both fairly minor. One of them is that file read to end and file read to string has got this really cool optimization now, where previously if you had like a vector and then you opened a file and you did read to end would just like start streaming the file into the vector, and the vector would just like dutifully double its size every time it fills. But that means that you spend, especially towards the end, you spend a lot of your time just reallocating the vector and copying over all the bytes that you've previously read. So reading a file ends up being this like sort of exponential process of copying bytes in addition to actually reading from disk. And what changed in 156 is that now file will first look at like inspect the file system and look at the size of that file. And as long if it can realize what the size of the file is, it will pre-allocate or sort of resize the vector to be that size before it starts reading, which should potentially significantly speed up file reads, which is really neat. It's also an indication that there are still pretty significant improvements that can be made to the standard library. So like, feel free to dig into there and just like find something interesting and start poking at it if something doesn't perform to your satisfaction. I think that's actually all. The other one is a smaller, I'll mention this as well, which is that if you have a macro invocation that uses curly braces, you can now use like dot method or question mark after that invocation, which is nice for things like if you're using the quote macro from the quote crate for doing like procedural macros and code generation, then you can now use quote exclamation mark curly bracket, write some sort of code that's going to be expanded into a token stream, close curly bracket dot into to turn it into a proc macro token stream that Rust expects. Previously, that dot into would fail to parse for relatively silly reasons, and that will now just work. So yeah, it's a big quality of life improvement for just like macros not being as weird.
That's kind of an obscure feature that we could like as a gift for people who actually listen to the entire podcast. Any macro invocation can use any bracket of you know parentheses, square brackets, curly brackets, and it's just not a big deal. Like you can have a print line with square brackets if you want, or with curly brackets, or anything. It just only convention stops us from having the vec macro with curly brackets. You can do whatever you want, and so ideally, all of these would act the same. This just makes the curly brackets act the same as the square and the smooth brackets.
Yeah, it's funny, right? Because with the square brackets, this already worked, mm-hmm. right? If you write like quote exclamation mark square bracket and then things end square bracket dot into, it would have just worked. So this was just an oddity for basically because curly brackets also need to be interpreted in other contexts, and there they have a different semantic meaning. So it's just like it was a really interesting to look at the PR too and see the reasoning for why this didn't work and why it now works.
Yeah, just a parser quirk essentially.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, and that's it.
Yeah, I think we got through all four releases. Pretty good.
And that's an entire year's worth of Rust development we've finished again. So this is our last 2021 podcast.
That's wild. We've been doing this for a while now, huh?
Yeah, we should do some kind of like celebration at some point, I guess. I don't know.
Well, I can do that right now.
Just waiting the entire time to use the soundboard, exactly. Weren't you?
Exactly. That's great. I'm excited to see what the new year will bring. And I believe that Rust cannot get any better. So I'm assuming that all following release notes will be empty.
Oh, yeah, we're done. It's it.
Yep. We all know that 2021 was the year of Rust on the desktop, mm-hmm. and now it is complete. There are no more bugs. There are only feature requests.
Mm-hmm. All languages have become Rust. They all submit to Rust. There is only Rust.
Yeah, every other language is now transpiled to Rust.
All CPUs now run Rust code directly. No need for compiler at all.
Yeah, microcode is also written in Rust now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's Rust all the way down. Every circuit on your CPU,
yeah.
No more logic gates, no more like transistors or neutrons, protons, etc. Just yep. It's all Rust code.
Yeah, it's Rust all the way down. Yep.
The fabric of the entire universe.
There's a turtle at the very bottom.
Made of Rust.
Yeah, made of Rust, yes. It's a rusting turtle.
Mm-hmm. All right, well, I'll see you next year then, John.
I will see you next year, and enjoy the holidays.
Happy 2021, as best you can, survive it, to all of our listeners.
Bye, everyone.
Bye.